Pearl Church exists to express a sacred story and to extend a common table that animate life by love. A primary expression of our sacred story is the weekly sermon. If our sermons inspire you to ponder the sacred, to consider the mystery and love of God, and to live bountifully, would you consider supporting our work? You can donate easily and securely at our website, pearlchurch.org, or follow the link in the podcast notes. Thank you for partnering with us in expressing this sacred story.
In your name we pray. Amen. You may be seated. Well, just before we get started, this has been an interesting morning. Not only is it, of course, daylight savings, so we've all, you know, suffered loss this evening. But also, sadly, Brian, our music director, came down with COVID last night at 7 p.m., we found out, and so Wendy has graciously jumped in. So thank you so much, Wendy, for jumping in to lead us today with Jude and Cheryl. So we really appreciate that. And as you can probably hear, I have also got the cold that's going around, so I'm going to be as far away. I will not be offended if anyone wants to scoot away from me. Doing our best here. During this season of Lent, we've been exploring the life of Moses together, bearing witness particularly to his many disappointments and likewise our own. Disappointment, that gnawing sorrow of unfulfilled hopes or expectations. Of course, our goal together is not just to merely wallow in our disappointments. The wisdom of the season of Lent and the way of Jesus suggest to us that our difficult human experiences are imbued with unexpected surprises and possibilities. And so in this series, we're making space, yes, to lament our many disappointments, but also being intentional to consider the potential gifts that disappointment affords us. Our desire is that this series will grow our capacity both to hold our sorrow and hope in the midst of the disappointment that we all encounter. Already, we've borne witness to Moses' abandonment, his sense of inadequacy, and disappointing outcomes in his life. And last week, we left Moses in Egypt, trying to liberate the people, but seeming to be a failure. Now, we're all familiar, I think, with the next bit of the story, because the narrative turns and things begin to go right for Moses and the people. Through divine intervention, the people are released from their bondage in Egypt and led by Moses in Exodus to the wilderness, heading toward the mountain of God. And of course, as we all know, the people are just so grateful and so appreciative of all that Moses did for them, and they just trust that the God who brought them through the Red Sea will, of course, provide for them. And so they gladly receive God's instruction, and they just make this quick journey to the Promised Land where they live happily ever after. No, of course that's not how it goes. No, in the wake of so much divine help, the people immediately begin to grumble and to complain and to make Moses' life difficult. I mean, within a matter of days, the joy of Exodus turns to the bitterness of hunger and thirst, and the people turn on Moses. As we read this morning, they camped at Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. The people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Moses, of course, is stunned by the people's response, and he goes to God and cries out, "What am I supposed to do with these people? They are ready to kill me." I mean, what a sudden turnaround. You would think that the people would maybe honor Moses for his role in liberating them or trust that if God could bring them through the Red Sea, that God could surely provide. But instead, they just continue throughout this narrative to grumble and complain and disregard Moses. They grumble about food. They grumble about water. And the second Moses turns his back, they assume that God has abandoned them and they build and worship a golden idol. Later, when the people finally do reach the Promised Land, they are distrustful and refuse to enter, instead declaring that they should just go right on back to Egypt. And it isn't just the people. I mean, it's the closest people to Moses. His brother Aaron and his sister Miriam, at one point in the story, attempt to stage a coup and grab at power. As you read your way through the narrative laid out in the books of Exodus and Numbers, what stands out strongly from Moses' story is how often he is disappointed by people. Despite giving himself his creativity and his care for the well-being of his community, he is met with distrust, suspicion, rejection, irritability, and just plain rudeness. Moses' experience, I think, is like that old joke you've probably heard. Community would be really great if it wasn't for all the people. Right? And we read this story of Moses and the people, and I think it resonates with us because, you know, we've all met people. You know, we see the people again and again behaving in disappointing ways, and we think, yeah, people are like that. We are like that because we've tasted it, right? We've been let down by the people in our lives in just countless ways, from the mildly irritating to the traumatic and devastating. Some of our disappointments are huge. Parents who are distant or harsh or abusive, friends who betrayed us, church leaders who harmed us, leaders who took advantage of us, family who rejected us, a spouse who left, the date who ghosted, the sibling who quarreled, the community that drifted. But a lot of our disappointments are just, they're just small and ongoing. Like that rough, sore spot in a relationship that just seems like it gets bumped no matter how carefully you try and edge around it. It just keeps getting bumped. Or the friendship that just, it just isn't as close as you wish it could be. Or that thing your parents say every time you visit them, which just drives your blood pressure up and up and up. You know, when are we going to have grandkids? Or something like that, right? Or the community you try to cultivate, but everyone's just a bit too busy, spread a little too thin, and you're just never quite with each other the way that you wish you could be. I think for many of us, the last 8 years have carried more than their fair share of relational disappointments as we've watched family and friendships bristle over COVID, over politics, over racial justice, over faith. And these relationships that we've treasured and counted on have grown strained or more distant than they used to be. We could go on and on. Every one of us have tasted the bitter sorrow of disappointment when others can't be what we wish. They can't treat us well. They can't stay. They can't commit. They can't listen. They can't understand. Maybe right now, as we sit here, you are holding a disappointment which is just sapping all the color out of life. We show up here week after week, each one of us seeking community and belonging and friendship and connection, and each one of us also carrying our wounds and our scars and mindful that we could be hurt again. How do we hold all this disappointment? What do we do with it? Today, I especially want to think about those small disappointments. A few weeks back, we talked about abandonment, and last week, we talked about disappointing outcomes. Later, we're going to talk about disappointing endings. So these kind of big, massive betrayals, we've kind of created some space. But what about the small things? What about those betrayals, those chronic little bumps and bruises that we exchange in our friendships, our marriages, our community? I think this is important to consider because often it isn't the huge betrayals, but it's those little tiny accumulating frustrations or irritations that just sap the joy out of our relational lives. This morning I want to meditate together on wisdom for life, which we see rising up out of the life of Moses and out of the life of Jesus. As I read Moses' story, there's this theme that seems to rise up for me, and it's this: Moses really owns his people. Like, they're just his people. Over and over again, Moses ends up in conversation with God about the people being disappointed, and Moses just says, well, these are the people. These are your people, God. No excuses, not denying the ways the people have been disappointing, but disappointing or not, these are the people. These are the people that belong to God, and these are the people that belong to Moses. I think there's a real wisdom here, and one that's especially important for our era today. I mean, for most of human history, your people were just your people. I mean, you were born in this village with this group of people, and for better or for worse, here you were, and you weren't going anywhere. No one was going anywhere for the most part. Your safety, your livelihood, your very identity just depended on being embedded in this tribe or this community or this place. But now, of course, we are just hyper-mobile. Okay, real quick here. Portland natives, can I just get you to raise your hands if you're from Portland? Wow. Okay, those of you raising your hands, how many times do you sell people that and they go, "You're from here? Ooh, a local." Right? Because most of us are from somewhere else, right? And that's more than just a statistical fact about Portland. It is a way of being in our era. It's an identity. We are individuals who, just for this moment, happen to be here in this constellation of connections and relationships, but we also are aware that at any time, any one of us could just move. Now, of course, mobility comes with all kinds of goods and all kinds of opportunities and freedom. It's a good thing, but it's also a hard soil for deep relationships to grow in. And I suspect that it makes disappointments appear louder and more dangerous to us. For Moses, there were no other people who were his. Disappointments and all, these were the people, and Moses is just immovably loyal to his people because there's just nowhere else to go. But in our world, stability isn't default. Mobility is. So when we encounter disappointment in our relationships, there's always this awareness in the back of our heads that this connection doesn't have to be permanent. I could cut and run. You could cut and run. And so any disappointment, any irritation might just be the first crack in our connection, which just deepens and deepens until we part. And when others let us down in the backs of our minds, we can conceptualize going elsewhere to find other people who would be better for us, who wouldn't let us down this way. Now, to be clear, there are times it's good to go. There are times when it is good to go. And many of us have had to make that hard decision to go. But there's a reason that the Benedictine monastics make a vow of stability. This people, this place, because staying put is the only way we can learn to really love one another, inclusive of all our disappointments. Staying put is the only way we eventually learn to be a people, and that our failures and frustrations are shallow compared to our bonds and our belonging. This is what Moses' life is, this long, enduring, patient love for a people which is just deeper than any frustration could be. In Wendell Berry's novel, Jaber Crow, the single barber, Jaber, finds himself enfolded into this small community of Port William until he comes at last to this vision of how the community belongs to itself and to one another. He says, "What I saw now was the community imperfect and irresolute, but held together by the frayed and always fraying, incomplete and yet ever holding bonds of the various sorts of affection. There had maybe never been anybody who'd not been loved by somebody, who'd not been loved by somebody else, and so on and on. It was a community always disappointed in itself, disappointing its members, always trying to contain its divisions and gentle its meanness, always failing and yet always persevering in a sort of will toward goodwill. I knew that in the midst of all the ignorance and error, this was a membership. It was the membership of Port William and of nowhere else on earth." So perhaps for us, a first wisdom for our relational disappointments is to see them in the context of membership, of our belonging to one another, irritations and frustrations and all acknowledged within this deeper context of belonging to one another. With Moses, perhaps we learn to say, "Yeah, I'm disappointed, but these are the people." Moses' conversations with God and the people put me in mind of another, much later and much deeper conversation with God, with deeper betrayal and deeper violence. In this season of Lent, we're on a path toward the darkness of Good Friday, where we find Jesus on the cross crying out to God, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Forgive them, they know not what they do." As I ponder these words, I wonder if there's some profound wisdom here in responding to the ways that we disappoint one another in relationship. Forgive them, they know not what they do. Now, I want to get at this by taking a detour, and this is going to seem a little weird at first, but just go with me. We're going to get somewhere. All right, have you ever been in a space that was built for someone not your size? Like, for example, you crawl into a kid's playhouse, right, and everything's teeny, and you're like a giant in the space, like Alice eating the mushroom and getting ginormous, right? Or maybe you went to an amusement park where everything is enormous. It's built huge to make you feel like you're a teeny mouse crawling through someone's home. What these throw into contrast for us is that ordinarily, we live in an environment sized for us. Right, where the majority of average adults are competent users of tables and chairs and cars and steps and computers and pencils. Everything is just sized for human average use. But of course, this is all artificial. And we feel this when we encounter vast mountains, precipitous ravines, towering redwoods. Like when we enter a cathedral, or we walk through an old growth forest, or we see the Milky Way stretched over the night sky in the wild. What do we do? I mean, our jaws drop, we hush, we wonder. We're in a space that's too grand, too vast. We dare not disturb it. Because here we're like children, we're like visitors to a grandeur that's beyond our grasp. But then, of course, we hop back in our human-sized cars and head back to our human-sized homes and turn on our human-sized TVs and watch humans doing human things. Okay, so now, we're finally back. We are competent adults again. We're back in charge. We live in a world built to our size. And what that does is it enables us to entertain the idea that we are knowledgeable, powerful, in-charge adults who are making their way through a world with competence and ease. But beyond that veneer is this unfathomable world of dizzying complexity before which we are children in awe, delighted but out of our depths. Now, in light of all this, I wonder if Jesus' teaching might take on a new resonance. Unless you become like a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. To be a child is not to be undignified. Children just know that this world is amazing. It's wonderful. It is too big. They don't control it. They don't grasp it. And for children, learning and development and play and trying and failing, that's all just normal and accepted. What if we allowed ourselves to inhabit our world as children together? What if we thought of ourselves more like a bunch of kids on a playground? You know, sometimes someone doesn't come through for us. They disappoint us. Maybe they just need a snack and a nap, right? Or sometimes when people say something that hurts us, maybe it's because they actually just don't know how to communicate better. They don't know what they're doing. Our toddler and preschool coordinator, Heather Griffin, shared a quote in a meeting that just stopped me in my tracks. She said, "There are no bad kids. Only good kids having a hard time. There are no bad kids, only good kids having a hard time." I mean, that's lovely, isn't it? I so wish that was how we had been raised, with such generosity and compassion. But let me ask, where's the cutoff age for kids? When do we go from being good kids having a hard time to bad adults who should know better? Is it possible that for all our maturing, we just go right on being children, just doing our best together? Just good kids having a hard time together. See, I think it's this vision in part that can allow Jesus to speak these profound and startling words even over those who are murdering him. Forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. For us to extend that to one another, to say in our disappointments, I think you were really doing the best you knew how. It doesn't negate our hurts. It doesn't make everything okay. But it does allow us with Jesus to create a space to say, they don't know what they're doing. We don't know what we're doing. And that invites us to live together with mercy, learning together, growing and forgiving. So what would it be like if we said to the people in our life, you're my people. I'm not going anywhere. If these disappointments and frustrations are here, that's okay, because our belonging together is deeper. It has space to hold us together as we figure this out. And what would it be like if we looked at all of our loved ones, no matter what age, and just said, you know, we're all doing our best, and none of us really know what we're doing. We're just kids. And like kids, we're learning and growing and figuring out how to be together as we grow. We're never going to fully arrive. It'll always be true that we don't really know what we're doing. So there's always room for mercy, for compassion, and for trying again. Now, none of this is going to remove our disappointments. We will bump and bruise each other in all of our closest relationships, and sometimes badly. But I think this wisdom gives us space to hold these disappointments within a context of belonging, within a context of mercy and of hope. Pearl Church, in our community, in all the ways we disappoint one another, may we receive one another as the people we are, this membership belonging to one another. And may we welcome one another as children, stumbling together into the gracious arms of divine love. Will you pray with me? God, in all of our disappointments, may we more and more hear the invitation to belong to one another, and the invitation to grow together, and to try again, and to grow even more.
We hope that this sermon inspired you to ponder the sacred, to consider the mystery and love of God, and to live bountifully. If you don't already support our work, will you begin today? You can donate easily and securely at our website, pearlchurch.org, or follow the link in the podcast notes. Thank you for partnering with us in expressing this sacred story.